This is Lena Miermont. I'm back with my Lena Life show. I have truly an extraordinary and very special program. Great opportunity to have a guest who is one of the leading figure in the cardiology. Dr. Steven Nissen will open a fantastic window in our understanding of modern accomplishments in the world of heart. We will confirm something we know already. We will be clearing some issues which we find some confusions. And in a short, I would say, the heart's issue of the heart's tissue will be the subject of our program. Dr. Nissen, welcome. Thank you very, very warmly to find the time in your extremely busy schedule and be very kind and resourceful with your information.
Well, it's my pleasure to join you and your listeners.
I frankly was absolutely drowned in the kingdom of your book, but preceding that, I got a little bit acquainted with some of your work, and I like to speak not only about your book, but also about some issues with the side effects of some medications, and also about some accomplishments in ultrasound technique, which helps us to see what's going on inside of the heart and condition of coronary atherosclerosis. But let me be proper and let me start with your book, which has very engaging and alerting title, Heart 411. And I like to ask you to give us first an overall post feeling after you wrote this book. What was your purpose of it? What did you feel you accomplished? And what do you feel we would have to do as patients to maximize the use of your book?
Well, first of all, I wrote this book with a partner, Dr. Mark Gelinoff, who is a very talented cardiac surgeon who I work with here at the Cleveland Clinic. And it was actually Dr. Gelinoff's idea. When he first proposed the idea of doing a book, I was a little bit reluctant because I have a lot of other, you know, things that I'm doing. But one of the things that convinced me to work with Mark on writing the book is that we went to the internet and we typed into a search engine a variety of search terms for diseases of the heart. And what we got back was horrifying to us. It was a series of just bad advice. You know, everybody, every self-described expert out there had a different piece of advice for people. What was the best diet? You know, how much exercise do you need? You know, should you take dietary supplements like fish oil? And what we realized is that the public is getting just bombarded with information. It's information overload. And we realized that something like 90% of the information available to the public on heart disease is just plain scientifically wrong. One of the things that actually stimulated us to do that is a very popular book that's out there now, written by Dr. Esselstyn, that promises that if you eat his diet, that your plaques in your coronary arteries will melt away. And, of course, we knew that that was complete scientific nonsense, and yet we had patients coming in and saying, you know, I don't need a bypass operation. I don't need a stent in my coronary. I'm just going to eat this diet, and all my plaques are going to go away. And so we wanted to tell people the truth, the scientific truth, and we approached it the way a judge would approach a trial or a jury would approach the trial. We weighed the evidence. We looked at the pros and cons. We came to a consensus, and then we wrote the chapters on the book. And so it's really about scientific truth for the public.
I certainly need to admire the fact that you belong to a highly sophisticated, world-renowned institution, which is a Cleveland Clinic. In fact, you're chairman of the Robert and Suzanne Tomsich Department of Cardiovascular Medicine, where indeed you explicitly developing your research and you shape this very clear understanding what we are supposed to do with our heart issues and, frankly, many issues beyond the heart issues. And I need to immediately address the fact that your book with your co-author is vast majority information which has to do with a lot of other issues. It's way beyond just the heart problems. It's introduction of the world of human health with the psychology, with understanding of medical and nutritional supplements. So I need to clarify for our listener the fact that you're making a very profound and comprehensive connection to other medical issues, and that is something which is very not too often when you have a specialist in one area and yet stretching all these threads, making logical and physiological connection with some other medical challenges. So
we don't, you know, I was going to say that it's very interesting that we started out to write a book for patients with heart disease, but we ended up with an awful lot about prevention. And, you know, I realized, of course, is that the ultimate goal of physicians should be to make their jobs unnecessary. And so, you know, if you actually look at the book, we didn't start out that way, but we ended up writing chapter after chapter for people on how to live a healthy lifestyle, because, in fact, the best kind of heart disease is the disease that you never get. And we think that it's something like 80 or 90% of the coronary heart disease that is seen in America is preventable.
And you couldn't be more right. And with the opening of other sphere and other channels, indeed, many of us can prevent so prematurely developing complications. I like to start maybe a little bit from the beginning, because I was very much intrigued by your historic discovery, where you found out that mummies who've been, I believe, opened up in one of the museums, confirmed the fact that cardiovascular problems indeed quite a long-term history problems.
I agree. And, you know, it's interesting. We found that very interesting as well, that we've tended to think about a coronary heart disease as being a disease of modern society, but actually it's not. And what someone did is they took the Egyptian mummies, who are very well preserved, and they did a CT scan of the mummies, and they could show with a CT scan that their coronaries actually contain blockages. You know, these are 3,000-year-old mummies. So it is a disease that's been around a long time. But what we've managed to do, of course, with our modern Western lifestyle, is we've managed to make the disease increasingly common. And it really wasn't a leading cause of death until the 20th century. In the year 1900, coronary heart disease was not in the top five causes of death. It was down around 7 or 8 or 9. Infectious diseases like tuberculosis were the leading cause of death, but not coronary heart disease. But then came all the things of the 20th century that have accelerated the disease: smoking, high fat diets, lack of exercise, obesity, and diabetes. And so we've created a monster here with our contemporary American lifestyle.
And pick up on this very sad reality, this monster, I would say that the other very clear and powerful, unbeatable connection you made between nervous system and depression and some tension and anxiety, which indeed provokes and sometimes really makes a major impact on a heart condition. I must admit that reading your book made one feel extremely comfortable, not that you're writing about very a peaceful subject, but it is comfortable because the more you read, the more you're developing almost like a self-dialogue. And the
it's true. It's absolutely true. And, you know, this mind-body connection is true for a lot of diseases. But, you know, there were some things that, in researching the book that we found to be very intriguing. In the country of Israel during the first Gulf War, when there were Scud missile attacks, people were under tremendous stress, you know, huddling in the rooms of their homes and putting on gas masks, and the rate of heart attack went up dramatically. One of the days that has the highest rate of heart attack in America is the day, the Sunday, when the Super Bowl is on television. And so you can see in a lot of the research that there is this very strong connection between anxiety, and of course depression is another story entirely, and heart disease. And so it really is a complex interaction between mind and body that's involved in the genesis of the disease, and we tried to address that in the book.
I'd like to continue a little bit in some general but extremely important points which you already made. But then after this, I'd like to go into some specific issues, some specific conditions which are so thoroughly and very transparently described in your book. So going into a general feeling and a connection between what you said, mind-body, I must again admire this work of yours because, again, just 5 or 10 years ago, you will read the book on a special subject, on a special theme with a special issues, and you feel somewhat quite isolated. And I'm stressing this fact of the connection because in our highly dynamic global climate of life, we really don't have that much time to internalize those connections. So your book is that connection. And I would, frankly, to use a much better description, very concise, by Larry King, who was one of the enthusiasts of your book. And I believe that because he certainly went through different phases of heart life himself. He beautifully described your book, and I like just to pronounce his words. He wrote that as a heart disease survivor, I look for the best information I can find, and I found it in Heart 411. In a world filled with information, conflicting information, Dr. Nissen and Dr. Gillenov separate facts from fiction. And that's what I wanted to ask you to lead to my another question. Imagination. We are suffering from negative imagination because of a lack of information. And our psychology very thinly sometimes reacts to our imagination. I found your book particularly very factual because it addresses psychologically different segments of the population. Did you have in mind to address this book indeed to different sociological groups, different even professional group, different educational group? What was your planning in your mind?
Well, that's a really interesting question. We struggled with that issue. When you write a book, you really want to have in mind a target audience, you know, who you're writing the book for. And what we realized is that, you know, we do have a society where people have, you know, a lot of variance in educational background, educational level, from very sophisticated patients. I mean, some of our patients come to see us and they have researched the topic of their disease in great detail. They have very specific questions. And whereas other people, you know, are completely lacking in any knowledge about their disease. So what we tried to do is to write the book at a level that would be meaningful for someone who, you know, kind of reads a newspaper every day, who's got a reasonable education, but isn't necessarily have an advanced degree. And then we put enough material in there for the very sophisticated patient that we hope that they would also find value. But you can't cover the entire spectrum of knowledge and background. If you write the book in too simple a fashion, you leave behind all of the very sophisticated readers. And if you write the book at too sophisticated a level, you leave behind a lot of the public that doesn't have advanced education. So we tried to hit somewhere in the middle, and I hope we were successful. But we always tried in the chapters of Heart 411 to have something for everybody, something for people with a broad background, from people who are less well-educated to people that are very, very well-educated.
Certainly succeeded, and maybe I'm stretching too far, but when I was acquainting myself with the history of the clinic, because Cleveland Clinic has such a legendary history, and I found out that indeed deep roots of establishing this clinic was in the hands and the talents of only four physicians. And they established this format, I understand, with the three objectives: patient care, I think research and medical education. And your book, frankly, makes everyone think way beyond even the facts and beyond the philosophy of what you're describing, because we all have our own approach towards our health according to our cultural roots, habits, traditions, and of course medical problems. So again, I would say that yes, this book is addressing very relevant issues, but it is really for everyone with no simplification, but very clear and very transparent description. Well, on this little comment, I like to go into some specific medical issue, and having a truly fantastic privilege to speak to the heart of the issue with a heart scientist.
If you'll excuse the pun.
Well, thank you for being so kind and gracious. I like to go into some common knowledge questions. However, they changing their ambiance sometimes on a monthly or sometimes yearly basis. Let me ask you first question about the aspirin. Is it beneficial for the heart? what is the connection with the high acidity possible side effect reaction from the stomach.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What's this kind of medicine does to us?
All right, so aspirin is a very complicated story. Let's begin by saying, what does aspirin do? Well, aspirin is a kind of a blood thinner. It makes some elements in the blood known as platelets less sticky. And it turns out that when platelets stick together, these little elements in the blood, that's the first step in forming a blood clot. And as I think most of your listeners know, a blood clot in the coronary arteries is what causes a heart attack. And so it was discovered by somebody in the 1960s, for which he won the Nobel Prize, that aspirin blocks an enzyme involved in causing platelets to stick together. And it turns out that for patients that have had a heart attack and are therefore at high risk for having another heart attack, if you give aspirin, this blood, very weak but effective blood thinner, you can reduce the risk of having a second heart attack. Now, there are some side effects of aspirin, including bleeding from the stomach and even bleeding in the brain. But if you're at very high risk for a heart attack, the benefits far outweigh the risks. The problem comes when people who do not yet have heart disease start to take aspirin. So let's suppose you're a middle-aged man or a woman, maybe in their 40s or 50s, and many people in that age group are told by someone they got to take an aspirin a day to reduce the risk of heart attack. Well, in those people, the risk of heart attack is low. And if you take aspirin, you don't prevent very many heart attacks, but you do cause an excess of stomach bleeding, and even an excess of bleeding in the brain. And so for an otherwise healthy individual in their 40s, 50s, even into their 60s, the risks of aspirin, in our opinion, mostly outweigh the benefits. And so for people that don't yet have heart disease, that are otherwise healthy, we do not recommend taking an aspirin a day. Now, you will find the opposite advice everywhere on the internet. We think that advice is wrong. And we think unless you've already had a heart attack or at very high risk for a heart attack, you shouldn't take aspirin every day.
Wonderful. One less expense. That's my conclusion.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll tell you, the tragedy is that some people are, in fact, harmed. You know, there's no such thing as a drug without side effects. I mean, every drug has an upside and it has a downside, and people have to remember that when they make decisions about what to take.
Absolutely. And we will talk about side effects a little later on the program when we will be talking about some medicine, and I'm a little bit impatient to touch on this FDA issue with a simvastatin, but I'm jumping ahead, and I am bringing myself back to the present moment, and that leads me to another question. Antibiotics and the dentist, we also have various approach. What is your approach, and what is your findings?
I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear that. My approach to what?
Your approach towards antibiotics and the dentist.
Okay, great question. Okay. This has changed in recent years. And so for most people now that have a heart valve abnormality, we no longer recommend taking antibiotics before having dental work done. There are certain people that are at very high risk in whom we still do recommend it. People, for example, that have a prosthetic, a plastic heart valve or a pig valve in place, tissue valve. Some of those people we do recommend getting antibiotics. But this common practice from previous years of giving antibiotics routinely to people that have a leaky or a little bit of a narrowed heart valve, we no longer recommend that they take aspirin or take antibiotics when they undergo dental work?
There is a little bit of a peculiar connection between bacteria or infection which occurs in teeth gum area and can go directly to the heart valve, even if
that's
heart
right.
Is fine. Is there any particular findings why there is such a connection?
Well, first of all, there are some interesting and complicated issues here. What I was talking about a moment ago is we used to give antibiotics to protect against infection of the heart valves in people that had leaky heart valves. So if people underwent dental work and certain other procedures would get antibiotics. And we don't do that anymore. But there is a fascinating connection between oral health and cardiovascular health and heart health. And it turns out that people that have bad gum disease have a chronic infection of the gum. That's what periodontitis, that's what that process is of gum disease. And that gum disease causes a generalized state of inflammation in the body. And we believe that that inflammation may contribute to development of coronary heart disease, because it turns out that inflammation is one of the drivers that causes the buildup of plaque in the wall of the artery. And so we generally recommend that people look after their oral health, you know, get regular teeth cleaning, brush and floss several times a day, because people with bad gum disease, it may be a risk factor, not entirely proven, but it may be a risk factor for developing coronary heart disease.
Thank you. That was so, so clear. And I think you just decreased greatly amount of people who will not buy dental floss this evening.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm sitting here in my office, and if I open up my desk drawer, I have several packages of dental floss sitting right here. So when I'm between things in my office, I can actually use it.
I'm so impressed. Some people using poetry, you're using dental floss, and I'm with you.
Well, I'm with you too.
I'm going to ask some sensitive question, and I think you will be extremely helpful here. I was very intrigued. In your section number 4, in fact, I'm holding the book because I was so intrigued. It's in a section where you're talking about personal plans. I will skip women and I will go right to the man. And you say that heart disease in men, it is all partly about sex. And in fact, word all is crossed. I thought it's misprint in a book. But then I saw this again, and it looks as if it is indeed crossed. So could you comment on this? This is very puzzling, and I'd like to know the bottom line on that.
Well, there, of course, this whole issue of gender and heart disease is very important. And let me first of all say that we know a lot about it, men do develop heart disease at a somewhat younger age than women do, we don't fully understand why women are relatively protected, but that they are. Women begin to catch up in the development of heart disease after menopause. And so if you go out far enough, if you go out to, to 70 years of age or older, then women have pretty much caught up with men with regard to heart disease. One of the more interesting things, however, about sex and heart disease that comes up is that one of the clues that a man may be in the process of developing heart disease is problems with erection, with erectile dysfunction. And if men have difficulty getting an erection, it often relates to the fact that their blood vessels are abnormal, and those abnormal blood vessels make it hard for them to get an erection. But it may be also that they have abnormal blood vessels with plaques developing in the blood vessels in their heart. And so in the book, one of the very frank recommendations we make is that for men who begin to develop difficulty with obtaining an erection, that they probably ought to be seen and evaluated for the possibility of heart disease.
Certainly, it is very overwhelming, wonderfully displayed problems, descriptions, solutions, recommendations. I was trying to get out the questions which will be appealing to the most of a population. And even though I hate to say common problem, because everyone is experiencing problem in their own rights, but I still hope that we will get at least some substantial fraction of what you described in your book. And I was thinking about migraine, because I found it's a very interesting connection between migraine and heart disease. People treating migraine only for what that is. Perhaps you can open horizon and make a wiser connection how migraine can be connected with the heart and be treated maybe more physiologically successful.
Well, migraine, of course, is a very, very common problem. And, you know, people want to know what is that causes migraines. And what causes migraines are changes in the arteries in the brain, where the arteries may be dilated and may put pressure on structures in the brain, causing there to be pain. Now, interestingly enough, some of the drugs that we use for treating migraine appear to have some issues, because they are drugs that tend to constrict the arteries. If you want to block the migraine, then one of the ways to do it is to give a drug which constricts the arteries. Well, you know, you don't want to constrict the arteries in the heart, because that's the source of the blood flow to the arteries in the heart and to the heart muscle itself. And so there does appear to be a small increase in risk of developing a heart attack for people taking a variety of different kinds of powerful medications for migraine. So there is a connection. Both heart disease and migraine are disease involving the blood vessels, and there is a commonality.
I like to talk about some preventable measures, some warning signs, and certain things which we need to be aware of. I found your book very helpful, because instead of being in panic state, one can learn certain symptoms, be aware of it, and then take obviously timely precaution. We all were stunned by number of premature deaths recently. Fantastic journalist Tim Russert, which is mentioned in your book, died with a absolutely shocking, totally unpredictable to all of us moment. We also have developed more and more young deaths among sport people. It's not a secret that this heart attack can be so massive that it can be instant death. I will ask you to comment on this death. I frankly was dying to know from a reliable source like yourself what really happened to Mr. Russert. And also, I do want to know to what extent sport people need to be also aware of the capacity of their hearts, but a lot of things going wrong there.
Yeah. Well, first of all, let's be frank. Sudden death is a major problem in our society. We can't get away from it. And let me give you some facts. In people that develop coronary heart disease, the first symptom of coronary heart disease can be sudden death. And that's the most tragic of all circumstances because these people don't know that they have the disease and something triggers a plaque to rupture, a clot forms, the artery is blocked, and there's a heart rhythm disturbance that results in death. One-third of patients with heart attacks in America never make it to the hospital. And that has not changed over the last several decades. We made great progress once people get to the hospital at preventing death and in helping people to recover. But if you don't make it to the hospital, then the modern methods that we have cannot be brought to bear. Having said that, many of these very serious events are preventable. And I cannot tell you how often we see patients who have sudden onset of chest pain. The pain that is pain of a heart attack is often in the center of the chest. It tends to go to the left or the right arm and sometimes up into the jaw. And people will sit at home for hours and they'll take an antacid. The pain won't go away. They'll walk around. They'll do a variety of things. They sometimes will do very odd things. A story that Larry King tells, he's quite a remarkable man, that when he had his first heart attack, he drove himself to the hospital, didn't call an ambulance, drove himself to the hospital, and he smoked a cigarette in the car on the way to the hospital with his first heart attack. But there's something that everybody listening to the show needs to know. If you have that kind of chest pain lasting more than 5 or 10 minutes, call 911 and get to the hospital right away. Do not delay. We usually recommend that if you think you're having a heart attack, you should chew up an aspirin, because it turns out that's one situation in which aspirin is beneficial. Why is it so important to get to the hospital right away? Well, we commonly see people who get to the hospital, and a few minutes after they get there, they have a cardiac arrest. If you have that in the hospital, we can resuscitate you most of the time. If you have it at home, the results are not so good. Second point is with modern technology that's currently available, we can stop a heart attack in its tracks. And the way a heart attack is treated by the most sophisticated centers now, 2012, is we take the patient to the heart catheterization laboratory, the X-ray lab. We put a catheter in the coronary. We find the block artery, and we open it first by putting a balloon in and then by putting a stent in that opens up the blocked artery. That can literally stop the chest pain immediately, stop the ongoing damage to the heart muscle, and has been shown to improve the likelihood of survival. Not just, impairment, but survival. And so sitting at home with chest pain for hours on end is a very bad idea. And people, when they're tempted to do it, and it's all about denial, they've got to overcome the denial, and they've got to get in to the hospital right away, because we can stop a heart attack before it's done much damage.
Thank you for being so explicit. Unfortunately, our medical care is not very supportive to our needs, well-known facts. And again, your book is extremely helpful because you're suggesting to have some absolute necessary tests. I'd like to ask you, what is absolutely minimum baseline everyone needs to have and indeed to be aware of their heart condition and to be more prepared in case if something goes wrong?
Well, that's a great question. It's a very important one because, in fact, Americans undergo too much testing. We do a lot of unnecessary tests, and that's why the cost of healthcare in America is approximately double what it is in other developed countries with advanced healthcare systems, like the European countries. What we recommend is that people sometime in their 20s should have their cholesterol checked. If it's normal, they may not need to have it rechecked for another 3 to 5 years. But they should periodically have their cholesterol checked and discuss with their doctor whether it would be advisable to treat it. We also recommend that everybody have their blood pressure checked. A normal blood pressure is about 120 over 80. When it gets to around 140 over 90, it's a problem. It may not need medication. It may just need a change in lifestyle. We have a specific diet that we recommend if you have high blood pressure. But those two things, cholesterol and blood pressure, everybody ought to have. Now, if people are overweight, they ought to periodically have their blood sugar tested to detect whether they are developing diabetes. And as you know, diabetes is an epidemic now affecting large portions of the population because of the increase in obesity. So if you are overweight, have your blood sugar checked. What shouldn't you have done? If you're healthy and you have no chest pain and no other problems, you should not have an exercise test, a so-called treadmill test. These are unfortunately done very commonly in people, but they're not appropriate, and they may need lead to a lot of other unnecessary testing. We also do not recommend routine CAT scans of the heart, something else that's become very popular in recent years. If you test, you may find some sort of an abnormality that may lead to more testing, to more procedures, and may actually do more harm than good. And so keep it simple. Blood pressure, cholesterol, and maybe a blood sugar test, and not a lot else, is necessary to stay healthy.
In fact, you're a little bit going back to the older times when a country doctor would know patients so well that he or she just will listen to the heart. No testing was available that time. So it was human to human. And I'm very much impressed by what you said, that it is somewhat an equality in between the patient's responsibility and knowledge what he or she needs to watch for, and not to take unnecessary advantage of costly testing. I want to ask you a couple of technical questions. What is your opinion of homocysteine? Do you feel that this is a good parameter for cholesterol?
Okay, homocysteine can be measured in the blood. It's been a very up and down, you know, at times very popular to measure. And it turns out that if you have an elevated level of homocysteine, you are slightly, just a little tiny bit more likely to develop coronary heart disease. You know, homocysteine is just a chemical that can be measured in the blood. What's fascinating, however, is that although we can lower homocysteine with medications, there's no evidence whatsoever that treating an elevated homocysteine level produces any benefits. And so we no longer recommend that it be measured.
And I like to go into this, I would say, your bravery, because you expressed your high medical principles where you stated that simvastatin has a tremendous, dangerously strong side effect. And I will let you to speak about this, but before you will give us your another very detailed clarification, I wanted to thank you for being so honest, so brave, as I said, and so incredibly helpful with clearing the issue of side effects, not only with this medication, but with some others.
Yeah.
So well, please talk about this.
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me just say that in the book, we are very supportive of using statins in the right people. Now, who are those people? And statins, for everyone, I think most people know, are these very effective drugs that lower the levels of the bad cholesterol, known as LDL cholesterol. Many of the drugs are now available generically, so they're relatively inexpensive. And they can lower cholesterol levels by 30 to 60% when given in full doses. If you've had a heart attack or a bypass, or a stent, you have known coronary heart disease, most people should be on a statin. The drugs are well tolerated, but they do have some side effects. Particularly in the highest doses, there can be an association with injury to the muscle. It's very rare, but can be serious. And so muscle symptoms with statins are a problem. But for most people, they're not a problem. The more controversial area is using statins in people that do not have coronary heart disease. And there, it's important to know what your risk factors are. How much risk do you have? And it turns out that if you're otherwise healthy, if you don't smoke, if you don't have high blood pressure, if you don't have, you know, other risk factors like diabetes for coronary heart disease, then unless your cholesterol level is very high, you may not benefit from a statin. And so it's really all about determining the level of risk with your doctor and finding out whether you'll benefit or you'll not. Now, recently the statins have gotten some very bad press because the FDA has warned that they can increase the risk of developing diabetes. It is important, however, to know that that increase in risk is a very small increase. In fact, it is so small that most physicians consider it to be not a major factor in the decision about whether to give a statin or not. And interestingly enough, even those people who develop diabetes while on a statin actually have the same benefits in reducing the risk of heart attack and stroke. So statins are safe drugs. They're not for everybody, but in the right patients, they can reduce risk substantially.
Well, we do have to face the end of this absolutely fantastic program, and I wanted to make my own conclusion as a musician and artist who is merging with journalism and curiosity in many areas I can attach myself to. And I have to say that in a very subjective and personal observation, I came to the conclusion that certain personalities and certain professions are living longer in people's heart than others. For example, conductors have a very long life. Some actors have a very long life. There is some invisible progression, I guess, with comfort or healthy emotions with the sufficient amount of cardiovascular work for the heart. So this invisible harmony produces a very long and fruitful life. And I like to conclude my program with one thought which Bob Hope expressed so beautifully. He said that if you haven't got any clarity in your heart, you have the worst kind of heart trouble.
Very good.
And I like to thank you very much because you indeed clear a lot of heart issues and heart troubles we had. And I think from this point with your book, with your incredibly kind disposition to give us this time, in fact, I wanted to thank you for making this time for the second time because last time we had some technical issues, which we're still working on, but I thank you so much for making this second opportunity for myself and my listeners. And I wanted to wish you the most of success, prosperity, and maybe if you will be kind again, we will meet again on the air for some other additional progress you made in the field of heart. Thank you so much
for having me. It was a pleasure to meet you over the radio. And please, for everyone listening, stay healthy.
Thank you so much. I, as usual, will continue on my post thoughts with my program today, having extremely talented visionary in the heart world, Dr. Steven Nissen, and his book, which I urge everyone to get as the only guide to heart health you will ever need. That's part of the title of his book, which called Heart 411. I also wanted to thank my listeners for giving me another opportunity to speak to this fantastic doctor and human being, because the last time we did have indeed some frustration with the technical issues. But I hope we caught up with our health, our hearts, our work, and our sustainability for our future. Until next time, that was Lena Miermont with Lena Life. Have a wonderful heart.